Famed remote viewer Ingo Swann saw structures on the far side of the moon. Richard C. Hoagland, who will join us next hour, sees structures on the moon. John Lear, our special guest tonight, sees structures on the moon. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this is going to be one of those programs where even if I wasn't hosting this show, I'd be glued to the radio. John Lear is a retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, as well as the son of the very famous inventor of the Lear jet. He's a Lockheed L-1011 captain, highly regarded in aviation circles. He has flown more than 150 test aircraft. He has won every award granted by the Federal Aviation Administration, and he holds 18 world speed records. He's worked for 28 different aircraft corporations, and during the late 1980s and early 1990s, John began coming forward with startling revelations concerning the subject of aerial phenomena and unidentified flying objects. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, John. How are you?
Good evening, George. It's an honor to be on your show again, and I think you are the best radio show host, bar none. Well, I wanted to tell you I enjoyed our time together at the Bay Area UFO Conference, and I'm sorry we didn't get to spend more time.
I got to tell you, it is a delight for me after so many years to interview guests like you, like Richard, and then when I meet you for the first time, it's really a treat for me. I mean, I never get over it. I'm still like a kid when I meet my very favorite baseball player when I was a little guy. It's the same kind of feeling, John, so it was great being with you, too.
That's great, and I want to thank or say hello to Bad Boy, the Nighthawk Zone, Spike Mike of Fantastic Forum, and my buddies at AboveTopSecret.com, which are Springer, and Skeptic Overlord and Simon Gray, who have helped me put this program together, and my associates Ron Schmidt and in Las Vegas and Beth in Florida.
Great. And I want to remind everyone, John has sent us some pictures, which are up on the coasttocoastam.com website. We're going to make some reference to them throughout the night. Get up there when you get a moment and just start taking a look at them. You know, John, your credentials are absolutely incredible. And the fact that you have been able to investigate and talk about some of these fantastic things that are happening on this planet and in this universe just adds so much credibility to it. There aren't a lot of people like you who come forward that you stick your neck out and say, hey, look, this is what's going on. But I'm beginning to feel like people with credentials like yours are beginning to do that now. Am I right in that feeling?
Yeah, most of the guys that know what's going on are hampered by their security clearance. But tonight I'd like to talk about how the government has been mining on the moon for the past 40 years and how the public, Congress, and most everyone else have been kept out of the loop, how Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Space Lab, the shuttle, and the International Space Station are all cover for what's really going on. As a matter of fact, we first started sending men to the moon in 1962. We were going to Mars in 1966 and have traveled throughout the solar system since then. And tonight, I'm going to show you the photographs taken by NASA themselves that will show mining operations currently in operation. And these are not artifacts of ancient civilizations on the moon. This is going on here and now.
Why covert, John? Why not just announce to the public, hey, we're on the moon, we're mining, we're getting minerals, we're doing all these things?
Yeah, that's what I want the listeners to email Michael Griffin, who's head of NASA, and ask him, why is this a secret?
Yeah, so we really don't know what's going on, do we?
No.
John, let's go back just a little bit before we get into this. Tell me about your interest in the aerial phenomena, the unidentified flying objects, something obviously captured your imagination and your attention.
It was Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time. I remember picking it up off the table at a friend of mine, Al Newell, here in Las Vegas, and I looked at that thing and I said, what's this? And I started reading it, and George, I'm telling you, the shivers went up my spine. I said, this is real. And one thing led to another. I eventually got to meet Bud in New York, and it was kind of funny because I was flying for American Trans Air, and I was so anxious to meet him that I had just come over from a flight from Paris. I had all my bags and my bag and my flight bag and my hang-up bag, and I went directly to Bud Hopkins' house, and I rang the doorbell, and when he answered it, he was in a kind of looked shocked. He thought I was moving in, and all I did is, you know, I had my stuff on the flight. And so anyway, we hit it off good, and he tried to do a regression. He said, look, you can't have this interest without, you know, having been involved, and nothing came of it, but that's what started it, Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time.
You took a little hiatus for a while, and now you're coming back strong again.
Yeah, I had a little time there when I thought that maybe I shouldn't be talking about this, but fortunately that passed, and now I'm back.
All right. Well, do you still get calls from some of your friends and colleagues who have flown, and do they still pass information on to you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the airline I left, which was not ATA, a couple of months ago, had a funny thing. The flight engineer called me. He said, you're not going to believe this. He said, "This is." They were in a 747 headed towards Seattle from back east, and they were over Chicago. It was at night, late at night, and they're headed westbound, and the center comes on and says, traffic 12 o'clock, 20 miles, 2,000 feet below you. And so they're looking out for this traffic below them, and here comes this huge white object, and it comes almost to within a mile of their craft, and then just instantaneously heads for the north and disappears in about 5 seconds. And they're all sitting there stunned, and the co-pilot finally says, now there's something you don't see every day. And, of course, they all burst out laughing.
Tell me a little bit about some of these photos that you gave us that we have posted on the website.
Okay, we have the photos starting with Apollo 8-12, 2209. It shows a picture of the Lomonosov crater, and what it shows is a city. And I'll tell you how I got into this. A few years ago, somebody sent me some pictures by Art Sweeney, who did drawings of stuff on the moon,
right,
that he could see through a telescope. And that put me into a friend who called me Bob Chirilla in Chicago. And he said, when you're in town, I want to show you something. And he showed me a book written by a guy named Charrington in Canada, who had a really good photograph of Lunar Orbiter 2162, and that was an oblique photo of Copernicus. And he showed me some tanks, vertical, you know, tanks, four huge ones standing up on the hillside, and that's posted in the pictures you got. That led me, about the same time, I saw Richard Hoagland's Moon-Mars connection about the six-mile-high object in the middle of Sinus Medi.
Right.
And so I ordered some photos from NASA of these pictures of Copernicus. Here's the deal, Jordan. Here's how it got so interesting. Somebody, now when you order pictures from NASA, you don't order it from them. You order it from National Space Science Data Center, or one of the mm-hmm. contractors. Somebody sent me, and I'll never know who it was, a 16 by 20 negative of 162H, Lunar Orbiter 2, oblique photo of Copernicus, which had not been airbrushed at all.
Oh.
And that stuff is, anybody can look at it. It's at abovetopsecret.com. You can go to that website and see that thing. What happened is I had no way to print a 16 by 20 negative. So that thing sat in my garage for 2 or 3 years until the technology got to the point where I could go to go downtown mm-hmm. and get somebody to print it. When I did, it was spectacularly clear. I took it over to Bob Lazar's, and it was so big that he had to make four different scans of it, and those are on abovetopsecret.com. And we started looking at it, and it was just really interesting. Those photos sat around for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then finally I went to abovetopsecret.com, and they wanted to put them on their forum, which they did. And it attracted so much interest. I think that one forum now, or that one thread, has got over 130,000 views now. And people started to contribute. Yeah, I see this, I see that. And we just amassed all these things that were going on Copernicus. It's obviously a mining operation. You can look at the photos that I gave to Lex that are posted on C2C. Mm-hmm. You can see cranes. You can see excavators. You can see buildings. It's all there. And then a few weeks ago, actually, it was around my birthday, I got to thinking, geez, I wonder if there's anything else. And I pulled out a book out of my library, and I went to that great book place in Portland a few years ago and cleaned them out of every NASA book they had. And a lot of them were printed way back in the 70s, which is before NASA got real talented with their airbrush. And I got this book called SP-246, and it's photos of Apollo 8, 10, and 11. It was published in 1971, and this just happened like in December. I started putting these photos on the scanner and looking at them, and it was just amazing. There is a city. I mean, there's a spaceport, what looks like a spaceport. There's tubes, there's roads, there's vegetation, there's lights. I mean, it's all right there. So I sent this one clip or this one photo of 2209 to Beth and Ron, and they looked at it, and they said, this is absolutely amazing. So from there, I started clipping more photos, and we found more and more stuff, and that's how it all happened. And those photos are the ones that you have on your website.
How do we know, John, if these mining operations are ours and not extraterrestrial events?
I'm sure they're part extraterrestrial. We couldn't have possibly put that massive a mining operation together in 40 years. I mean, we could have. I don't think we did. Somebody else is up there. Somebody else built all those buildings. There's no possible way we could have done that.
You think we just kind of inherited them?
Yeah, I think, I think we work with them up there. Now, I don't know who that is up there, but they're the ones that built all that, and we're doing mining. Now, the reason I know that we're involved is several years ago, I ran into a real honest-to-gosh government insider. He's dead now, but he told me three things, and one was that we had been going to the moon since 1962, that the population of Mars was 600 million, and they looked just like us. And incredible. The other thing was that he had worked on a piece of mining equipment that was to go to the moon. He said, John, he said, we built this thing down in Alabama, way out in the nowhere. He said, it was so enormous. He said, when we finished the project, he said, I actually rented a little airplane. He said, I'm a private pilot, and flew around this piece of equipment just to get an idea of how big it was. And I said, geez, that's fantastic. How did they get it to the moon?
Yeah.
He said, I don't know. And that's, you know, the deal in compartmentalization. You get to know a little bit of the program, but you don't get to know the whole thing. So he knew a little bit, but he didn't know the whole thing.
What an incredible...
Now, if you ask where the operations are from now and how they keep them so secret, I think it's Antarctica. And if anybody wants to check Google search words, I recommend two things. One is moon mining. You're going to be absolutely stunned at how much there is. I think there's 1,500,000 hits on moon mining and space law and Clementine. Just Google those things and see how much there is.
A couple of these pictures you sent us, specifically the crater Kepler, and then you look at the airbrushed version. Two different, it looks like two different craters.
Absolutely.
I mean, the structures are all gone.
Yeah, like I said, NASA didn't get proficient with their airbrush till about 1972-73, and they went back and got all these pictures. But those of us who got the early pictures have the good stuff. And on Kepler, you'll see the Lunar Orbiter 3-162 picture. I mean, there's obviously stuff on the crater. There's obviously a strip mine there. There's obviously buildings there. And then you go to the Apollo 12 photo that was taken several years later, and it's absolutely clean.
It's
there isn't a trace of anything.
Well, they came down and took all the equipment away. But
yeah.
You're right. It is absolutely incredible. Now, how do you know, though, in some cases, we're not looking at tricks of light or just different images when you look at this?
Well, take a look at that yourself. I mean, there's buildings on the rim. And then there's not buildings there. Some of the pictures are great. As a matter of fact, did you see the one of of Aristarchus. You know, we're always told that Aristarchus is the brightest spot on the moon. We can see it. And any image you can buy or purchase or moon pictures, it's always just a white blob. And so we had a guy take a 10-inch telescope and take a picture for us, and you can see it right in those pictures that we've got on your website. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful structure, and it looks exactly like a nuclear reactor to me. It's probably a fission reactor. There's no doubt about it. You can see the arches. You can see the blue glow, and the blue glow comes from when radiation hits molecules mm-hmm. of air. And now you're going to say, wait a minute, there's no air on the moon. Well, as a matter of fact, the moon has a breathable atmosphere, and it has gravity 65% of what's on Earth. So, you know, it has it has all of that.
And it looks like it's got some arches alongside
yeah.
of it.
Yeah. And then you look at the next picture. I think that Lex got it up there. Look at that picture that Clementine
took
in 1994.
Right now.
Can you imagine that we got a better picture of Aristarchus from a 10-inch telescope than Clementine did with a $100 million satellite? Oh, that's great. I love it.
It doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
It doesn't.
So all this has been going on, you think, right under our noses for 40 years, John?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, somebody pulled up some stuff off the Internet that my father was involved in. In the middle 50s with Andy Grav, and there's a lot of stuff. If you Google Bill Lear, William Powell Lear, Andy Grav, he was there doing it. He was right in the middle of it. As a matter of fact, there's a 3-minute clip floating around that was originally in David Hatcher Childress video mm-hmm. of my dad lecturing on UFOs at the Bonston Laboratories. And he's there at a blackboard. He's got a saucer there drawn on, and he's describing how it works. The film is silent, but you can see generally what he's doing. Interspaced with the pictures of him are technicians working in laboratories with balsa wood and paper UFOs. They're obviously trying to make, you know, what was the beginning of our efforts. I think that all came to a culmination in 1959. We made the craft. We may have had some help, but anyway, our first trip to the moon in Andy Grav was 1962. Now, let me tell you this. You say, well, Andy Grav, we don't hear very much about it. And I say, that's right. You don't hear one word about it. You don't see Aviation Week and Space Technology putting, you know, we're working on Andy Grav and here's the experiments. Nothing. Not one single word. And the reason is they already perfected it and they don't want anybody talking about it.
I want to get your reaction, Sean, about this talk about why we never technically went back to the moon. Why did it seem to end publicly, yet we continued going back then?
We were already there. That was all a cover. Those guys, you know, the Apollo astronauts, the first guys to set on it, they weren't the first guys. That was all just a cover program so that nobody would know about the real program. Now, why they wanted to keep the real program a secret, I don't know. But you can ask, you know, if the listeners want to email Michael Griffin, NASA administrator, they're welcome to do so and say, hey, how come this way? You know, John Lear's got some pretty good evidence here that that we're already on the moon and we're mining up there. What's the deal? You should know. You're the administrator.
What are they mining for, John?
That is a good question. What we think that they're mining for is helium-3. And helium-3 would be an excellent power source if we can get fusion together.
That could power the planet for years.
Yes.
Stay with us, John. We'll be back with you in just a moment on coasttocoastam.com. Our special guest tonight, John Lear. And again, if you have a computer, I hope you do by now, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Look at the assortment of photographs he has sent us. Take a look at them. See what you see. We'll be back. And our very special guest tonight, John Lear, as we talk about mining operations, structures on the moon. You know, it was my late aunt, Shafika Caregula, who knew Ingo Swann. And Ingo, through his remote viewing and in his book, Penetration, said that there were indeed structures on the far side of the moon. It's an incredible story. We'll be back with more with John Lear on Coast to Coast AM. I'm afraid, John, you've got a lot of people staying up late tonight. Poor Liz in Ann Arbor, Michigan says, George, I'm a college student. I've got to get to bed. I have to stay up and listen to this whole show. It's going all around the country. John, let's talk a little bit more about the moon, and I want to get into some other things with you. The Gary McKinnon story, which is absolutely incredible. He's the one who hacked into U.S. Websites, military websites, including NASA. Back to the moon for just a moment. So you say we went up there in 62. What do you think the purpose was? Was it to begin mining or just to do more military work?
Well, we have a laser weapon on the moon. We have a lot of stuff up there. I don't know all that's up there, but the mining is the big thing. And you might wonder, who owns the mineral rights of the moon? Did you ever wonder that?
Good question.
Well, you'll find that 95% of the mineral rights on the near side of the moon and 50% of the mineral rights on the back side of the moon are owned by a group of three individuals. They're Americans. They've had it for 25 years. And in fact, this same group owns the mineral rights to most of the solar system. And you can check this out in the website or Google Universal Mineral Leases Registry, and you'll find their names, their government contractors, some of them.
Are they
Dr. Joseph A. Resnick, Dr. Timothy R. O'Neill, and Guy Kramer. And they own all that. Now, how they got it, I don't know, but it's theirs.
I mean, did they have to write a huge check for this?
Apparently, they didn't have to write anything. But, you know, just Google
Weird.
It.
Okay.
Google Universal Mineral Leases Registry, and those three names, Resnick, O'Neill, and Guy Kramer, and they all have little government contractor, little companies that contract stuff to the government. Now, you know, there was a space treaty that said that nobody would own the mineral
rights.
That's
right.
No country. But apparently there was nothing in it that said an individual couldn't own it.
So these three are out there. They're alive and kicking somewhere.
Absolutely. They're working. They've got companies. And they're the ones who hold all the rights.
That's incredible. I got to find them. I've got to find these people. Can you imagine if they are mining the moon, how much money they are making?
Yes. If it's helium-3, they could be making billions and billions. Now, we don't have, the capability, at least that we know of, to use helium-3. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Bob Lazar this evening, and he sent me an email. I said, can we use helium-3 right now? He says, no, it's kind of a future fuel. Once we get fusion reactors working and on an efficient basis, helium-3 would be a useful fuel. As of today, though, we have no fusion reactors, nor have we produced a sustained fusion reaction, or have developed the containment necessary to allow the reaction to continue without eventually destroying the magnetic or laser system.
So we could be just storing it up.
We could be storing it up, but the problem is that the plasma generator in the fusion reaction is as hot as the interior of the sun, and it's difficult to deal with the stuff like that. It also generates neutrons, which destroy the matrix of metals, making them brittle and crumble after time, no matter how tough they are. So it's thought that a liquid metal would be better as a shield system, and liquid continually reseals itself as opposed to solid metal that retains and accumulates the neutron damage. Now, what we're looking there in our Aristarchus, that big, beautiful thing there, is probably a fusion reactor.
Is it possible that these structures on the moon might have been created by intelligent earthlings millions of years ago, looking at that old movie From Earth to the Moon? Maybe we went to the moon a million years ago. Maybe there was a very high advanced civilization and they set some of this up. Is that possible, John?
That's possible. We're told that that the Earth is the only habitable planet in the solar system, and it's not. All of them are habitable. All of them have people similar to us: Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus, Pluto. They're all habitable things. And NASA calls them giant gas bags. But the only giant gas bag I know in our solar system is spelled NASA.
Now, if you're sitting down for this, Lex tells me he's done some quick research that two of the three players you mentioned about the mineral rights,
yep.
Resnick and Kramer,
yep.
He says they were involved with HAARP.
Oh, really?
Now, that's an incredible angle.
Yeah.
I mean, they're everywhere, these guys.
They're everywhere. And if Lex will Google moon mining, he'll just see how much stuff is on there. And, of course, NASA says we want to go back in 2020. And what we think is now they want to dovetail their, you know, dovetail this in so that they won't be caught up there, you know, mining. They get this all this thing together where, you know, in 2020, we're going to go up there and mine the moon when it's already there. I don't know whether they want to, don't want to be caught in the lie or what, but when I talked to somebody about this program, NASA's position was, look, John, we don't want to be called liars. If you could just say that we haven't been totally forthcoming.
You said they were on a couple of years ago with ART. We're going to check that and see what they had to say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that could be an interesting.
Excellent.
Maybe they were just talking about HAARP. I don't think they were talking about their mineral rights.
Well, they've had these mineral rights for 25 years.
So old Gary McKinnon decides to hack into some government websites and computers and realizes that he's looking for information about UFOs and extraterrestrials, and this guy could get 80 years. I guess he's got to be punished for something. He did break into our computer system, but I'm not sure 80 years is fair. But what do you think this guy was really hacking into?
He was just seeing what he could find, and what he found was a list of the Secret Astronaut Corps. The Secret Astronaut Corps was formed at the same time that the Public Astronaut Corps was formed. But the Secret Astronaut Corps were the ones that were going to the moon in 1962, you know, and here we were just making suborbital flights and then finally an orbital flight.
So they had to shut him down very quickly.
Absolutely, because he has the goods there, and he's getting 80 years for what essentially I'm telling you.
You know, NASA issued a report just a few months ago that said that JPL may be withholding and might have withheld information from us, from the public, and they've called for an investigation. I found that to be an interesting story.
I love it. I love it.
You have looked into the horrible tragedy of Apollo 1, where Grissom White and Ed Chaffee died. But you believe there was another astronaut involved. Tell me about that.
Right. That was the fourth thing I forgot to tell you. The insider told me is that he was there when it happened. And when the fire occurred, what happened is NSA, the National Security Agency, who control NASA, they went to the top of the gantry there, and they sealed off the area for 45 minutes, and they took that one body out. And what they didn't want anybody to know is that, first of all, that someone was there, and they could, and they wouldn't be able to tell who he was because he was part of the Secret Astronaut Corps. So they had to keep him. I had to keep the incident quiet forever and ever, and they paid off the family, and it's been a secret ever since, and it would still be a secret if I hadn't found out about it. So I started researching it, and, you know, I got, you know, one of my NASA insiders after, you know, some liquid persuasion, and I got the name of the guy. So if anybody comes to me and says, I think I don't know who that was, say, what's his name? And then I'll know whether he knows or not who the guy was. Now, as you know, at the Bay Area Conference, when I gave my lecture, we had a question and answer period, and one of the relatives of one of the astronauts that burned in the fire got up and said, the story is true. We all knew there was a fourth astronaut killed in that fire. And people say, well, I've seen Apollo, there's no room. Oh yes, there is. There's plenty of room down there. As a matter of fact, the Apollo head, I think his name was Bill Shea, was supposed to be in there that day, and for some reason he wasn't. But there's plenty of room down there for, not plenty of room, but there's room for a fourth guy to help through all those countdowns and some of the problems that happened.
Do you think the initial plans for the Apollos might have been to have four astronauts go all the time?
No.
Just the three?
Yeah.
Well, what a shame, though. Definitely a tragedy. And again, the reason to cover it up is because it was the Secret Corps.
Right.
Jeez. I mean, John, how much of this has been going on, and for how long? I mean, it seems like there's every area of government where there's some kind of suppression or non-disclosure or secret. It seems like it's in everything.
Yeah, you know, President Eisenhower warned us about this, about the industrial complex. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, I used to think if somebody was relatively well-informed, if they, you know, read a couple newspapers, a couple weekly magazines, you know, kept pretty much on what was going on, that they knew about 5% of what was really going on. Today, I don't think they know anything. Absolutely nothing.
When you were flying planes, did you think, beyond your wildest dreams, that you'd be stumbling into information like this?
Never. Never. I thought, you know, in those days, you know, the SR-71 was the coolest thing. I knew guys that flew it. I was the first guy to find out, you know, where Groom Lake was and start talking about it, and I thought that was the top of the top. What's interesting is there's a group of SR-71 pilots that that get together every 2 years in Las Vegas here. They're called Roadrunners, and what they were the original Blackbird pilots after the CIA. Of course, you know, the CIA started the Blackbird program. There was 13 what they called articles, and those are single-place airplanes. When the Air Force found out about it, that the CIA was flying back Blackbirds, they went to the Pentagon and said, hey, this is not right. We're supposed to be the guys flying spy missions. So the Pentagon turned it over to the Air Force. They went to Lockheed. They made the YF-12A, which was proof of concept for the SR-71. They made three of them, and then they made about 34 SR-71s. The guys that got the CIA guys ran it until about 1967. So anything prior to that, this association is called Roadrunners, and they call before the Blue Suiters got into them, and they meet. And the reason I'm telling you this story, George, is because when they get together, here it is, 2006, they toast their drinks to each other saying, and we're still the fastest. Now, that airplane, let's see, it's 2006, that's 40, it's 46 years old. Can you imagine somebody thinking that that our technology hasn't improved in 46 years to go from Mach 0.32 to something else?
No, when everything else has, and you add one more year to it as we begin 2007, you're absolutely right. I mean, just look at how the computers have advanced in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the 40-some-year technology, no, there's no way.
So, you know, when I was flying and involved in that, I had no idea that I would ever stumble across anything like this. And then when I stumbled across it, you know, I met Bob Lazar, and whatever you think of Bob, you know, I believe he was there. I knew him for the 2 years, you know.
And you believe him?
Absolutely, totally, 110%. I went through that whole thing. It's just, you know, people say, oh, you just believed a story. No, I mean, he was the one that, you know, said, hey, John, they're going to test fly a saucer tomorrow night. Do you want to go see it? And me and Gene Huff and him and Bob's wife drove out there, and there is a flying saucer. And, you know, I had it in my Celestron 8 telescope, and I saw it. And so they say, well, you know, maybe he was just a cook up at Groom Lake. And I said, well, if he was just a cook, then they tell the cooks when the flying saucers are going to be tested.
Yeah, exactly. And you're saying these launches to the moon are done at the South Pole?
I believe so, yeah, because if you Google Antarctica cargo, you will see a tremendous amount of traffic going into McMurdo and the other bases around there, a tremendous amount.
And I would guess launches from there would remain relatively secret.
Well, absolutely. And since they're anti-grav, they don't make any noise. I mean, they just head up to the moon. I doubt if it takes more than an hour to get there.
Are you telling me these things travel that fast?
Oh, absolutely. They're anti-grav.
My God. You mean once they get out of the atmosphere? Or from the get-go? Are they that fast from the get-go? What kind of G-force would be on somebody?
None, because the it's anti-gravity. You're carrying your own gravity with you.
So there's no G's at all?
Absolutely not.
That is just like warp drive, and off they go.
Off they go. And there's a tremendous story on AboveTopSecret.com. There's a guy that posts there, and you talk about a guy that has been around the universe. His name is Sleeper, and it sounds crazy, but I believe this guy has been there and done that. And he has a blog. You go to AboveTopSecret.com and find Sleeper and find his blog and read what this guy has to say. It's just fascinating.
He knows too much, doesn't he?
Well, he knows a lot, and I just love to read the guy. He grew up in Italy. He eventually went into the Army, and the stories he tells about the Army taking him to, you know, to these saucers and turning him over and walking down these plywood corridors and going off for a month or two are just, I mean, I believe it.
We are starting to get some incredible UFO reports lately, John, by really credible people, you know, pilots again, military people. What do you think's going on? Why these sightings again? I mean, are we just in another flap, a UFO flap, or is there something else afoot?
Probably something else afoot. I think those are our guys. I mean, we've had some fantastic vehicles, not as good as the aliens, but, you know, we do pretty good. All those black triangles are ours. They're not aliens. They're made down at Lockheed. They travel around. This big thing at O'Hare, you know, that's probably us going out there, you know, for some reason, and I don't know what it is, probably to take our mind off Iraq.
That's an interesting thought. I've always believed those were ours. As a matter of fact, I know an editor for aviation magazine who is sure that those triangular objects are ours. Now, I don't know if they were reversed engineered, but he says what's flying around now is ours, and he says they're always by a military base.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bunch of new secret bases. There's one in the middle of the Nevada test site. It's not technically Area 51. It's 35 miles west-northwest, called Sandia. And it has three runways. They test a lot of things out of there. There's another one up by just to the south of Wendover, to the southeast of Elko. As a matter of fact, there was an article in the Review Journal, Las Vegas Review Journal, in January. Now, I had known about this one particular secret base that was just to the west of Dugway. We followed its progress and everything. It was kind of interesting. I had a friend who went deer hunting, and he was the one that originally found it. So we watched it for a couple of years, and then January of this year, Las Vegas Review Journal ran a story that the military was asking for a third large restricted area over Nevada. Now, there's the Nevada test site restricted area. There's the one up at Fallon. And then they wanted a third one. Guess where the third one was? Wow. Right over this area that's just to the south of Wendover. So, you know, I took it to my friends. I said, hey, looky here. They're putting a restricted area right over this secret base.
I love it. We're going to talk about your theory about the moon being towed into place. That's an incredible one. That's a controversial one, John Lear, as you know. And then we're going to bring in Richard C. Hoagland next hour to chat with John. Richard, of course, his Moon-Mars Connection video showed that six-foot-high tower in the center of the visible moon. That was one of the things that sparked John's interest in all of this. We're going to have John and Richard just chat during a portion of next hour. And then the last hour, John will be here for your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. John, tell us a little bit more about Richard Hoagland's Moon-Mars connection that helped get you interested in some of the moon work.
It was fascinating, but just let me slip this in here. Ron Schmidt, who has helped me with all this and done tremendous research over the past 2 months, has a website, thelivingmoon.com and landoflegends.us. That's thelivingmoon.com and landoflegends.us. And just a quick shout to Hank McCoy and my daughters Allie and Jax and their friends Trish and Matt. Now, when I saw that Moon-Mars connection of Richard Hoagland, it was absolutely fascinating. And so I started researching all the stuff that that he had shown in that. And that's what led me to all of this research I've done. I mean, Richard is a fantastic guy. I've talked to him many times on the phone. He showed me some pictures. He had one hidden. Not hidden, but he didn't name it, and it was on his website. And since the name wasn't there, I didn't want to say, hey, what's that,
yeah,
you know, and make a jerk so out of myself. So I waited a couple of days, maybe a week or so, and then I finally sent it to him. I said, what's that? He says, he emails back, and he says, you like? And I said, Richard, I'm going to wring your neck unless you tell me what that is. And it was a structure rising out of Tri-Snekkers about 60 miles high. It was fantastic. Anyway, Richard is a great guy.
Well, I'm going to invite everybody in now to listen to this conversation between you, John, and Richard Hoagland as you talk about this issue of Moon Mars. And so come on in, everybody, along with Richard C. Hoagland, the head of the EnterpriseMission.com. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Our national campfire, George.
Absolutely. It is. Look, Richard, I'm going to do this a little differently this time. I'm going to I'll interject every once in a while, as I always do, but I kind of want a conversation between you and John. I mean, both of you have come up with just some startling revelations of issues on the moon. Rich, I want you to talk to him about what you showed me at Joshua Tree, that incredible robotic head. But go ahead, just chat. Have some fun.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me acknowledge someone who's really important on our team. You met him at Joshua Tree, Steve Troy.
Yes, I did.
Who has done some incredible work going back about 10 years. I believe, John, part of your photographic montage that you sent over to Lex was the crater Kepler.
Yeah, and that's Steve Troy's picture.
Exactly, and that's the area you call the city. Steve has been over that with literally a microscope and was showing me that like 8-9 years ago, and we were finding things in some of the lunar orbiter stuff that actually to this day has not been published. He's actually going to have a three-dimensional computer modeling of some of that now crafted by some of our VTR friends. And he has done such amazing work. As I was saying earlier tonight, you know, George, you don't believe in coincidence.
No.
Tonight I did 2 hours with our old friend David Livingston on the Space Show,
mm-hmm,
which is the show that he has that kind of has co-opted all of the alternate space people, the engineers and the NASA people and the disenfranchised contractor people, all the people that can't understand what Griffin is really up to, because nothing about the New Moon Initiative really makes engineering sense, and we might get into that in a little while. Anyway, I did 2 hours with him, basically no holds barred, the gloves came off, and I talked about all the bizarre things that I'm going to be showing in Los Angeles at the Expo in a couple, 3 weeks. You think you have seen something, George, amazing? Wait till you see what I'm going to show you next, my friend.
All right. All right.
Now, John, I'm hoping you can get over to L.A. for this. This is the first weekend in February 9th through the 13th.
Okay, I'll make it a point.
At the L.A. Hilton.
Okay.
Because I got to tell everybody, you know, everybody in America in this extraordinary audience, John is one of the few people that I both immensely agree with and immensely disagree with at the same time.
How so?
Well, John is a pilot, all right? I'm a physicist. My background is astrophysics. John is a very savvy layman in this area, listening to certain sources, and he's got the right ballpark. You know, he's in the right solar system. But some of the specific interpretations of the imagery that he has presented, from my analysis and my colleagues, is not exactly on point. But that really doesn't matter, because if you're in the same solar system on this, it's a home run. There are structures on the moon. There are artificial structures on the moon. Some of them are old, incredibly old. Some of them are new. I don't know how new. I don't know whether we're mining for minerals. Minerals is kind of passé when you get to this level of exploitation of celestial objects. Frankly, John, I think we're mining for the retro-engineering of the ancient technologies that are deep under the visible and battered lunar surface. Can you imagine what it would be worth to find a working device that could produce free energy, forget helium-3, that could tap into the zero point directly, bring it back to Earth, figure out how it worked, and then have independent free power forever and lock it up, have the sole ownership of that technology. I mean, there's lots to mine on the moon. I don't think it's minerals. I think it's technology and the ancient science of those who came before.
And we're looking for it with a bucket wheel excavator that's 100
feet high. Well, yeah, because on this show a few weeks ago, remember, George, I made a big deal about the so-called Ina Formation?
Mm-hmm.
This is a formation, John, that was made a big deal of by a couple of guys at Harvard a few weeks ago with a paper in Nature. There's an area kind of like in the dead center of the moon, just above the center of the moon, about 3-4 miles across, looks like a kind of a horseshoe, called the Ina Formation, I-N-A. It is supposedly the youngest, cleanest, sharpest, smoothest area on the entire moon, as judged by the orbiter and Clementine and other photography. It also is brilliantly visible in titanium bands, meaning it has a lot of titanium on the surface. In fact, it's the most titanium they found of any spot on the moon. It looks to me, again, coming at it from a different perspective, as an excavation. And what really cinches it, as I said on Coast, is that it's at 19.5. It's 19 degrees north, 5 degrees west. So somebody excavated a 3 or 4 mile area, like a super archaeological expedition, to show us dumb Earth guys when we got back to the moon, if that model is correct, if we were there before and we're going back now, where to look, because all the surface stuff is really beaten to hell in a handbasket. If you want to find pristine things, things that still work, things that you can learn from, if you want to find the libraries, you've got to dig below the surface. And it looks to me, and I'm going to lay out the evidence for people coming to the expo in L.A., that somebody did us an incredible favor at this code latitude and longitude of 19.5, so we would go there and look at what's there, and that's one of the areas that I want the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter in 2008 to target, because, George, it will have almost the same resolution for the moon as we have with MRO of Mars, which is inches across.
What's fascinating, though, is you and John, regardless of what's going on there, agree that something is happening on the moon.
Well, I agree something happened. I'm much, much, much less certain because I don't see it in our data that something is happening. The only place where I've seen structures, and I use that term in quotes, which look pretty new, like they're really, really kind of
ongoing,
brand new,
yeah,
would be on ramparts, John, in Tycho. When you look at Tycho, at some of the lunar orbiter pictures, you see this huge 60-mile-wide impact crater, and then you see around the edges on the inside what they call abatements, which are flat areas that look like lava had pooled after the heat of the impact. On some of those, there are absolutely incredible, regular geometric structures that do not look as if they have been shattered and bashed by meteors exposed for millions and millions of years. They look very, very, very new. Now, the problem that I have with the whole new idea is that on the moon, because there's no, and this is going to get John really intrigued, no atmosphere. We'll come back to that, right, John?
Yeah, there's a breathable atmosphere,
okay.
I agree.
This is where John and I really, really disagree, all right? But let's hold that for just a second.
Well, you're in good company because Bob Lazar doesn't believe it, and Ignorant Ape doesn't believe it, so you have good company.
Well, but I've got evidence, and we'll go through the evidence for the audience because, in other words, what everyone needs to know is that John and I are not just picking this out of, you know, strange parts of our anatomy. We have data. And we're looking at this data through certain sets of eyes, our background, our expertise. You know, I haven't flown an L-1011 lately, but, you know, he hasn't looked through a really...
I think I'd rather fly with John than you, Richard.
I think so, too. Okay. My point is that we all bring our individual expertise, and the truth is somewhere kind of in the middle.
Sure.
And that's the way real science works. You know, you can have wonderful disagreements and respect people, but not agree with their interpretation of specific pieces of data. In general, John and I are in incredible agreement up to and including the idea of a secret space program. Let me get back to that in a minute. But let me finish this one point. which is if you look at these structures in Tycho, they're so crisp, just like the Ina structures, which, by the way, are buried several hundred feet below the lunar surface. That is a depression, which you can see easily on the Apollo imagery. There's a huge excavated, it looks like an ancient archaeological excavation in the Middle East. Somebody took away all the overburden, all the regolith, all the lunar dirt and soil and rock, and exposed what was lying there underneath, which is crisp buildings, exquisite crisp buildings. And Steve was able, through NASA, through some of our friends, to get actual very high generation negatives where we made prints at a special lab that we use. We then scanned them, applied enhancement techniques, and I'm going to show you incredible human scale buildings that are crisp, not battered and bashed and broken, but crisp in the Ina formation. And we see the same kind of new stuff in Tycho. But the problem, again, as I come back to, is how new is new? Because on the moon, things will look new for 1,000 years, 10,000 years, half a million years. So then I think we might be, and again, I'm open to other suggestions, but I think in terms of the new stuff, we might be looking at stuff from the last cycle, George, the high civilization you talk about,
yes,
the so-called Atlantean era, which would be 13,000 years ago, the last time this planet went boing, like it might do again coming up on this, you know, Mayan calendar date of 2012. We're at the end of that 12,000-plus-year cycle, and that's why I'm concerned about the whole 2012 thing. Let's go back to the moon atmosphere. The key reason
Before we do that, keep your train of thought here. You're talking about 13,000 years ago. Who's mining Copernicus? Those pictures I have. There's cranes. There's vehicles. There's buildings. There's everything there.
How do you know that it's current?
The dust is rising. The vapor is rising.
But John, the vapor is descending.
That stuff is not going to last for 13,000 years, Richard.
John, it may not be dust.
Pardon?
It may not be dust.
There's a lot of glass.
There's shattered remnants of domes and structures, spires. By the way, the Treisnecker thing is only 10 miles high, not 60, okay? It's about the same height as the Cuban tower that you keep asking me about.
Yeah.
This is vapor that's rising.
There's at least six examples of vapor rising. It's not glass.
No. But glass looks like vapor under certain light scattering conditions.
Why would there be a triangular shaped piece of glass coming out of a tank? It's vapor. It's like the Lick Observatory picture that we'll get that was taken in 1946 that I showed you, and you said it was an artifact. It's not. It's smoke. It was an explosion.
The problem with Lick is you're looking with a relatively small telescope to the Earth's atmosphere, and I would trust nothing from Earth up until the recent CCD stuff because we just didn't have the resolution.
Earth looks pretty good to me.
Well, but looks good and numerical measurements of good are two different things, John. As you know, if you're flying on instruments, you got to trust your instruments, right?
Yes, you got to trust your instruments.
So in this case, you got to trust the numbers.
It comes down to numbers. Pardon?
It comes down to numbers. Let me go back to why I don't think there's a breathable atmosphere on the moon. Okay.
Okay.
If you look at the moon, George, have you ever looked through a telescope of the moon?
All the time.
Okay. You notice how the moon is drifting about one diameter to the left, or actually in the telescope, mm-hmm. be upside down, it'd be to the right. Every hour?
Yes.
It moves at about 2,000 miles an hour.
Right.
The moon is about 2,000 miles in diameter, so it moves its own diameter every hour in orbit around the Earth. Occasionally, it will move in front of a bright star. As it does, the star will wink out at one edge, and then about an hour later, depending upon where it crosses, it'll come back at the other side. It winks out really almost instantly. If there was an atmosphere over a quarter million miles, the star would twinkle violently for several seconds before it disappeared, because the atmosphere would be like the Earth's atmosphere, where if you look across the valley, I'm sitting here at roughly 6,500 feet tonight looking down on the Rio Grande Valley, and even only a few thousand feet up, you can see the street lights and the car lights twinkling because of the heat effects of the Earth's atmosphere.
Should it have weather?
Well, if it had an atmosphere that was dense enough to breathe, it would have weather. You would see clouds.
There's plenty of clouds in NASA photographs. And, you know, with all due respect, Richard, you know, you sound like the Flat Earth Society when they used to, you know, say, convince everybody the Earth is flat. Look, you walk 100 miles west, it's still flat. You walk 100 miles south, it's still flat. You can walk 1,000 miles to the north, and the Earth is still flat. Now, how can you tell me it's going to be a sphere? That's what it sounds like, Richard.
Because I take a space picture, and it's a sphere. John, if you look at the numerical data, science is numbers. Ultimately, it comes down to numbers. The moon doesn't have an atmosphere because the stars don't twinkle when they go behind the edge.
No, that's an earthbound
scientific... No, it's physics anywhere in the universe. Atmospheric convection will cause twinkle.
I'll tell you what. Let's settle this. Let's get a ride up there. I won't wear a spacesuit. You wear a spacesuit. We'll step out on the lunar atmosphere.
And see who's left.
I'll be able to breathe because the atmosphere is equivalent to 15,000 feet on Earth. The guys that live up there, they go through a 24-hour decompression, and, you know, they can breathe it fine if they're outside.
Let me ask
if they're in a dome, they don't have to have supplemental oxygen.
Let me ask another question. If you can answer it, and maybe you can answer it because of certain, well, you'll see when I ask the question. What is your source on the lunar atmosphere?
Somebody who's been there.
Ah, so you're believing somebody who says they've been there.
Absolutely positive.
Okay, see, I'm basing it on evidence that's democratic. Anybody can look at it. I don't have to trust anybody to tell me the truth. I just look at the numbers. I look at the pictures. I look at the lack of scintillation.
But you believe some of your sources, Richard?
No. What I do is I use my sources as early warning radar, like the dew line. When a source tells me something, I use that to then go and get hard evidence that actually I can independently corroborate. When I come on the show, except for certain political things where I definitely couch them as this is a political statement
right,
or a political
right.
thing, I am not giving you what someone has told me. I'm giving you the data that I have found that corroborates what someone told me.
That you interpret.
That I interpret because it stands still.
Okay, Richard, my data is Apollo 8-12, 2209. It shows what looks to be a spaceport. What do you think is there?
Well, I don't keep all these photos. Well,
and this is just one photo.
I know. Well,
don't forget, Richard, and this is coming from the guy who sees a face on Mars, right?
Let me go look at it. Is it one of the ones you sent Alex tonight?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, see, I haven't been to the site to be able to
All right.
See
I tell you what, we're coming up on the break. We've got another half hour to go with Richard C. Hoagland and John Lear. Next hour, we're going to keep your phone calls going with John Lear. It's a fascinating discussion. We're going to talk more about structures on the moon. We're going to give Richard an opportunity to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and take a look at the photograph that John just mentioned. And it's fascinating because Richard, you know, John has just questioned Richard to look at some of the structures that are on the moon right now. And, of course, you know Richard's theory. He sees a face on Mars, the one in Cydonia. So we'll be back. There's still another half hour to go with these two. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as I mentioned, next hour we'll keep John Lear. We'll take your phone calls. We'll put Richard in a spaceship and jettison him next hour. But we'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, John, you mentioned Sleeper's website, and I've got a lot of people who missed it. Can you mention that again for me?
It's on AboveTopSecret.com. And Sleeper is a poster there, and he's got a blog. So you go to AboveTopSecret.com, get to Sleeper, and then go to his blog, and you'll read some of the most fascinating story you've ever read. Hey, Richard, I have a question. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. What do you think is the largest gas giant in the solar system?
NASA.
Okay, at least we agree on that.
Trick question, but you got it right, Richard. Okay, have you looked at those pictures?
Yeah, of course.
What do you think?
Well, there's some really interesting geometry.
Mr. Face on Mars, what do you think?
The name of the game is geometry. And frankly, John, I see more interesting things than you have highlighted. I mean, to the right of the blue thing that looks like a crab to me, you know, with the two arms coming out, I see very rectilinear things that, you know, again, it's hard to tell because we don't have a scale. You know how big this picture is? How many miles across?
Yes. Lomonosov, I think, is 50 miles. We have the scale written down somewhere. But, of course, we left a lot of that. We didn't highlight very much.
Yeah, there's a lot of regular
stuff. Look at the obvious thing to the left there. You know, Ron Smith said, hey, should I highlight that? And I said, no, why don't you just let them find that? I mean, there's so much stuff around.
Well, there's
there.
A lot of very interesting regular things. I mean, that's what's really, you know, the kind of clincher. In a place, George, that has been smashed and battered by random impacts for billions and billions of years, which is the NASA, you know, view, you should not have regular geometric features that look like,
Look like a spaceport, right?
Well, I would say an airline terminal. All right? I mean, since we're not down there, we have no ground truth, we don't know what this stuff is. I very carefully try not labeling things except kind of like tongue-in-cheek because there's no way without ground truth of knowing whatever this stuff was used for until we get there, until we land.
Well, we could ask the guys that are there now when they come back.
If we can get them to tell us the truth. You know, I'm fascinated that you are talking to somebody who claims to have been there. I would demand a slightly higher level of proof, John. Well, how do you know he's not giving you a wonderful shaggy dog story?
Oh, we get some wonderful stories.
I'm sure. I do, too. I don't believe them unless they give me something I can check. And that's the key thing here. We've got to be able to check it. You were going to talk about the moon as being towed into orbit.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was just going to ask you, Richard, what you think of John's theory. And then, well, let's have John elaborate on that first.
Just for some new listeners,
we get thousands every day. John, tell us about that.
Okay. Norm Berggren wrote a book called Ringmakers of Saturn. Norm's bona fides just are fantastic. I mean, he worked for 40 years for major, major aerospace companies. He was Lockheed 20 years. He's just a fantastic guy. He's 85 years old now. He got a hold of some Voyager pictures, and he was the one that showed us those big, huge vehicles in the rings of Saturn. Anyway, part of his theory is that the moon was placed in orbit in rotational lock. And this summer, when I was at the Bay Area UFO conference, I went to see him. He was at Stanford Hospital. He injured his shoulder. I drove over, picked up his wife, and took her over to see him, and I had an hour with him. It just fascinating. He's so alert, you know, and just really a great guy. And during the conversation, I said, Norm, where do you think that EMV, the electromagnetic vehicle that placed the moon in orbit around the Earth, where do you think it is now? He says, on the backside of the moon. Now, you have to understand that Norm Berggren was on the inside for many, many years. So if he says something like that, then you can be sure it's probably there. So when we started looking around Tsiolkovsky, the crater that looks like it has a little nice island in the Mare there, Beth in Florida started unmasking it, and there is what appears to be a huge EMV electromagnetic vehicle. And I think that's probably the one that towed the moon into orbit. Now, let me just read you. I asked Norm, would you email me a statement? And here's what he says. And also when he talks about the video, we're talking about the Apollo 17 video when they flew over Tsiolkovsky and they filmed it at that time. And that video is on on the internet, but I'm not sure. Anyway, here's what Norm Berggren says. Quote, the still images show the kind of illuminations one might expect of an EMV. Video, however, shows changing light variations well outside the highly illuminated area, suggesting that more is still going on than is evident in the stills. More work remains to find out how all of this fits together in the effort to try and answer specifically the what. We believe we have taken a step forward in calling attention to this very significant activity found on the moon. And that was written by Norm Berggren yesterday.
Well, Richard C.
Richard, what do you think?
Well, all right, I'm coming at this from a little different perspective. I agree that the moon is not natural and it was towed into orbit.
You do agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't published the data yet.
Why does it look all...
Because
smashed up.
Because it's a natural body that was...
Maybe it was an asteroid or something huge like that.
Remember Arthur Clarke's third law? any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right.
If you have the level of technology that I think was operative in the solar system quite a while ago.
Well, so you're saying it's a natural object towed
in. I think it was a natural object modified and towed into orbit, placed in orbit around the moon, around the Earth, to allow life on Earth to exist. In the hyperdimensional physics, which we, of course, don't have time to get into tonight, if the moon didn't exist, we wouldn't be here either.
And Velikovsky
would not be here.
Velikovsky has numerous references of a long time ago when there was no moon.
Well, we're talking a long time ago there was no moon, yes. Now, the difference between Berggren and me is that, you know, when I look at an object on the surface, there is no way I can tell what it's used for. It's geometric. It doesn't belong. It's not natural by the criteria established by people like Sagan. Remember Sagan's great line? Intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself through the geometric regularity of its construction.
Mm-hmm.
That is a maxim that's useful anywhere, not just in the solar system, but anywhere across the galaxy and the universe. If you took a picture of a planet 500 light years away and somehow got it back here, I could look at it and, depending upon the resolution, tell you whether anybody had ever lived down there based on the geometry of the things we see in the image. That's the only remote sensing criteria we at the moment have to go on. So, you know, you look at this thing in Tsiolkovsky, and Berggren thinks it's an EM vehicle. I have no idea what that is.
The electromagnetic vehicle.
Yeah, but I know what it means, but I just don't know how he could possibly tell. He's looking at light and dark pixels in a picture. How can he tell what it's used for? It may be a geometric shape that's not natural. How does he know it's a vehicle? I have some more interesting supporting data in favor of the artificial toad moon hypothesis. Back when I was advisor to Cronkite, I met the head of the lunar seismometry experiment, who was at Columbia University. He was a PI. NASA had picked him to design the seismometers to listen for moonquakes.
Okay.
And we spent considerable time because it was one of the things that I figured we could make available to people that would kind of humanize the space program. What I wanted to do was to turn the seismometer readings into musical notes so that when we tuned in his instrument, instead of seeing squiggly lines on a piece of paper, which nobody could interpret except a scientist, we could actually hear the rumblings of the moonquakes in the moon. All right? So I got kind of close to him and his experiment, and I followed it during the entire mission. Well, when the first readings came back from the first seismometer put in place on Apollo 11, all hell broke loose. When they impacted the S-4B, which was one of the upper stages that sent them to the moon, vectored it into a crash on the moon rang like a bell for over an hour. And nothing on Earth seismically ever does that.
Well,
so
that makes it sound artificial, though.
Exactly. And in years later, I have figured out how this works technically by the numbers. Anyway, they put several more seismometers with the rest of the Apollo program down at the Apollo 12 site, the 14 site, the 15, 16, 17. In other words, we had a small network of seismometers. And by having a network and correlating the data, you can get a crude CAT scan of moonquakes going all the way down to the core. About 10, 11 years after the landings, they got enough data that this guy published a paper in Science, which I've got, showing two incredibly huge, definitely geometric, definitely symmetrical, definitely arc-shaped structures or masses or something buried, you know, a thousand miles beneath the surface of the moon down near the core, symmetrical about the Earth-Moon line. As soon as that data was published, NASA turned off all the seismometers, claiming they couldn't afford to keep them running. The cost to keep those seismometers running and get more data on the interior of the moon would have been about the cost of coffee money for NASA headquarters for a year.
Maybe they didn't shut them off, Richard.
Well, exactly. Maybe they just told us they did, but they've kept the data running.
Right.
The point is, I believe that what the scientists found on the seismometry data were the engines inside the moon, George, two huge symmetrical masses inside the moon that were used to move the moon en masse by changing the inertia, by using gravitational warp effects to move it, not by rockets or EM effects, but through gravitational inertial changes, and that those engines are in the moon waiting to be investigated if we could find the way down to the core, which, of course, there has to be.
Interesting. Where do you think the moon came from, if it was towed there?
Okay, here's another piece of hard data. When Apollo 15 landed, they did a core tube. In fact, they had a big problem. David Scott, who was the lead astronaut, can be seen on those films pounding and pounding and pounding and trying to get that core tube first into the moon. It was much too resistant for a natural soil surface. And then he had a lot of trouble getting it out. It turned out to be something like 15 or 18 feet long, broken into sections and put in the lunar module, then brought back in the command module. When the scientists investigated the analysis of this core tube going from the top all the way down like 18 feet, it turned out that there was a very sharp break in the composition of the gases that were impinging on the lunar surface at about 1.5 to maybe 1 billion years ago. It almost looks like the moon orbited one kind of star that was evaporating gases like the corona.
Sure.
And then was brought here and then exposed to the sun's corona, which has a very different chemical composition. There's this incredible sharp break, which absolutely makes no sense unless the moon was moved from one environment to the other.
You agree with that, John?
I'm just glad I didn't have too much more to say.
And, of course, this data is in the NASA archives. Anybody can look at it, look it up online, and come to their own conclusions. The thing is that when you're trying to grapple in these very, very far-out areas, it takes more than one swallow to make a summer. It takes more than one piece of data to reach a conclusion. That's why I don't talk about a lot of this stuff until I've spent years looking at a variety of inputs, a variety of sources, a variety of papers, and tried to synthesize a picture that will explain all the disparate evidence and then make a prediction or a set of predictions about what we should find next if, in fact, the far-out theory is true.
Why, again, is the moon necessary for our existence?
Because in the hyperdimensional model, you require a large gate between three dimensions and hyperspace, and the bigger the mass orbiting faster, the more open the gate is and the more the energy comes through and allows living things to be here.
So without that, is it blocking?
Without that, you get bacteria. That's why there were nothing but bacteria, cyanobacteria on the Earth for billions and billions of years until the moon was brought here, which was roughly 500 million years ago.
Well, John Lehrer, you're not going to change your mind. You claim we're still mining there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Take a, you know, and the audience, our listeners, can just look at it and see for themselves. There's no doubt about it. Go to above.topsecret.com, pull up those Copernicus pictures, and just sit there and put them on your imager. And it's just fantastic to see all the stuff that there's there. There's buildings, there's cranes. What's interesting is we call the smoking gun. There happened to be the Copernicus oblique pictures, lunar orbiter 2162H. There just happened to be a lunar orbiter 5155M that shows the identical picture but taken 2 years later, and it shows down, and you can see the same stuff there. You can see the cranes, you can see the buildings, everything, the vapor, or as Richard says, the glass. The glass is still there.
I think it's scattering off glass, and in terms of artificial sharp objects that are new, we don't know, John, how old they could be. They could be tens of thousands of years old and look like they were put there yesterday.
Why the public perception, then, that we're going to go back to the moon if we're already still there? Who wants to react to that? How about you first, John?
Well, they're trying to dovetail their operations now into what we're going to do, because eventually they're going to have to say, yes, you know, we're there mining the moon. They're going to have to come clean on this eventually.
So they want to kind of merge
into that. Yeah, they want to merge that.
You agree with that, Richard? Well, of course, you don't believe we're mining the moon.
Well, George, it's not about belief. It's about evidence. John is much more certain about this than I am. I am incredibly uncertain about a lot of things because what I see are ancient ruins. I see a few things that are much, much less ruined, and i.e. then newer. I don't know the time frame. I have no ground truth. I have no data that says when this stuff was done. I'm looking at meteor erosion rates. I'm looking at NASA papers that say that in X number of million years, you get this amount of degradation. That's how the INA story kind of came together. What I'm waiting for is the new missions and the politics converging, because I do agree on this. Because the world's technology has now caught up to us circa 1969,
mm-hmm.
and the Chinese are going, and the Indians are going, and the Japanese are going, and the Europeans are going, and the Russians are going, George Bush had to go back to the moon. Now, he can't admit that he's got this incredible super-secret space navy with anti-gravity that Gary McKinnon tripped over, and they're going to fry the poor guy for it. So he has to pretend that we have to reinvent Apollo. Apollo on steroids, as Griffin called it. And we go back to the moon with, you know, something stupid and primitive like rockets. But it's all, as John said, it's a con game. It's a face-saving procedure to try to bring these two ends of the paper together. And because people will not be there day by day by day, if, in fact, there is some mining going on, and I think it would be excavating for artifacts, there's going to be no way to say, wait a minute, you've been doing that for 20 years. They could claim it was 20 days. Who's to know?
Richard, you keep saying that we're there, and then you say we're not there. What is it?
It depends on what we're there for.
No. Are we there now?
I don't know. The honest answer is I don't know.
What do you think that Space Corps is doing?
I think they're going a lot farther than the moon.
Well, yes.
And, I mean, look at Iapetus. Look at the stuff in the outer solar system.
They're going to all those places.
I think remember, you got to ask yourself, what's the point? You know, if we're so far ahead of everybody, if we have a lock on this technology, what are we doing out there? Well, that brings us to this, you know, the big question no one wants to talk about. Do we have enemies in space? Do we have bad guys that might not want us to leave the solar system? Do we need space defenses?
Well, if we don't, we're sure.
Is Iraq War merely a chimera for a real conflict?
Richard, if we don't have enemies, we'll certainly manufacture some.
Yeah, that's true. David Jacobs thinks we do have enemies up there.
Yes, and Steve, what's his name, says no.
Stephen Greer.
Stephen Greer.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got, again, a difference of honest opinion. I value David's opinion. I value Stephen's opinion. I don't know because I don't have ground truth. That's why I went into artifacts as opposed to UFOs. Because with the artifacts, if I get imagery and I use physics and light analysis and proper computer technology and I have multiple sources, multiple missions, multiple countries now, like the Mars Express versus, NASA's data. I mean, there's some astonishing Mars Express imagery of Sidonia, George, which, again, if looked at properly, confirms extraordinary things.
All right. Richard, got to run. I want to thank you. You're going to be at the Life Conscious Expo,
Conscious Life Expo. February 9th, and we're going to knock people's socks off with absolutely amazing photographic evidence of stuff on the moon.
EnterpriseMission.com. I'll be back in a moment with John Lear, and we'll take your phone calls. Fascinating hour with you two. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie, John Lear with us. Your phone calls. We have put Richard in a capsule and have sent him on his way.
Thank God.
You love the guy, John.
I love him.
Where would we send him? To the moon or Mars? Where do you think?
Just encapsulate him.
Or just let it keep going.
Listen, I wanted to say hello to Sally, Moppy, and Aaron, and I wanted to remind the listeners that they can see all this data on thelivingmoon.com. TheLivingMoon.com or LandOfLegends.us. All this stuff here that Richard just can't quite swallow. Take a look at the pictures yourself. Take a look at the evidence.
I love hearing you and Richard get together on this because, you know, what's fascinating is, of course, the expert of Sidonia and Mars. He brought that forward along with the several other people. And
well, I can't match his intellect. The thing is, George, I have the truth on my side.
Well, you know, you both come at it with different perspectives, and that's refreshing.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. You ready,
okay.
John?
Let's do it.
First time caller line, you're on with John Lear on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George, John. My name's Rob, calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hey, Rob, thanks.
Hey, yeah, I'm really glad to be finally getting through. I've tried a couple of times before, but didn't get a chance to talk to you guys. I had a question and a comment. I wanted to know if, John, if you had put any filtering on any of these photos that you've put up on the web. I've been filtering them in Photoshop for the past couple of hours since I first heard they were up, and I found a couple of interesting things. First off, if you negatize the images, they look like daytime shots from Earth, you know, atmosphere, things like that. And there's the sky, you can obviously see where it seems like scratches were made in the actual negatives of on the film to make the appearance of stars.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if you had a chance to filter anything yet, but I've just been doing that constantly for the past 2 hours. I'm just trying to.
No, one of NASA's problems with this whole Apollo program, with the moon program, is there is an atmosphere and there's gravity that holds the atmosphere in, and the sky is not black. And that's why those 15 truckloads of videotapes disappeared, is because they had no way to change the color of the sky. And so actually, if these are daytime shots, the sky is going to be blue or yellow, whatever it is. I don't know what color it is. I've heard that it's yellow. I've heard that it's blue. So that's what we're looking at there, and that was what NASA was faced with, and that's why some of the photo that was released to the public looked so fake, is because they had to blacken out the sky.
Okay, and I guess that's why when I negatize it, the sky giving it that quote unquote fake white look makes it look more like a daytime shot.
That's right.
Okay, well, great. I really appreciate that.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate you being a part of the program. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Hey, John, I was wondering if there's any way to look at the geologic record and see if there's any evidence of there not being any high tides or low tides prior to 500 million years ago, and also if you think any other moons in the solar system were brought here from somewhere else.
I'm sure they were. There's, as I said before, all the planets are habitable. People similar to us live on them. Aliens live on them. There's certainly many of the moons were bought and put there.
Okay, and I just wondered about the geologic record. I have no idea if there's any way to tell.
You know, I don't know, but you could go to thelivingmoon.com and email Ron. He could help you.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks.
Okay, tell us about the soul catcher, John.
The soul catcher is the, what I think is the 6 mile high tower in the middle of Cygnus Medi, right in the middle of the center of the moon. As you look at the moon, as you know, it's in rotational lock. It doesn't move. The same face points to us or toward Earth at all times. And the famous photo that Richard found, Lunar Orbiter 384M, shows that huge tower. And he also has two other photographs that show that tower. I think that tower is what I call the soul catcher. When you die, your soul is that goes to the soul catcher, and when you're born, just after you're born, they shoot your soul back into back down here into a small baby, probably 1 or 2 days old, sometimes as much as 2 or 3 weeks old. They want to be sure that the baby is going to live before they put a soul into it.
And that's where they store them?
Up there, yeah, that's one place they store them. Apparently, they have other places. Sleeper, who really knows a lot about this, had a really interesting thread, and I think you can still find it on AboveTopSecret.com, and it's called "Are Extraterrestrials Real as the Nose on Your Face?" The thread is about 120 pages long, and it is so full of interesting information, and he talks about this soul issue.
Amazing. Let's move next west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, John. This is Richard in Humboldt County, California.
Hi, Richard.
Guys, we have these great rovers on Mars that have been operating for 4 years already. How come we don't have anything like that on the moon?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe we do, and they don't tell us, John.
No, we don't need those on the moon. We got guys up there mining. All they do is trip over them, and they've got business to do up there. They've got vehicles riding all around. They don't want to trip over a moon rover. They already know all they need to know about what's up there. Why would they put a moon rover up there?
Those rovers on Mars, though, have just worked splendidly, haven't they? Way beyond what anybody thought.
Absolutely. They go, you know, a mile this way, a mile that way. It's fantastic what they can find out. And, you know, I think, I forget which vehicle it was. I'm trying to think now, Spirit, I forget, a year or so ago.
Spirit and Opportunity. Two different ones, yeah.
Which was the one that ran out of power and the solar panels were...
Might have been Opportunity, but then the wind blew off or something.
No, the wind didn't blow, George, or whoever said that. Our secret astronaut team went up with some Windex and some Bounty paper towels and cleaned it off.
On Mars?
Yes.
No.
Absolutely, positively, without a doubt.
We flew up
to Mars. I got that from an ironclad source.
We flew up to Mars.
You can take that to the bank. We've been flying to Mars since 1966.
Polished it up.
And polished those solar panels up, and it's worked great ever since.
And then they came back.
That story about a dust being blown on and then blown off, it's fantasy. I mean, if you want to believe that stuff, it's okay. But NASA has people who sit there and dream up that stuff. Well, let's tell them a whirlwind came along and blew the dust off.
See, I'm still waiting for that picture of an alien looking in on the camera or something like that.
No, the people on Mars look just like us. There's no alien up there. They're just like us. There's 600 million of them. Most of them live underground. They're a nice bunch of people up there.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hey, Happy New Year, George. This is Blair in Sedona.
Oh, thank you, Blair. You too.
Thank you, sir. And Mr. Lear, you know, it's interesting, George Adamski's 1955 book, Inside the Spaceships, page 157 and 158, mirror exactly what you're talking about, breathable atmosphere, even vegetation, and it's located on the rim, you know, from the view on Earth, so we really can't see the clouds because they're not as thick as they would be on Earth, but they are there, and he says it's even temperate on page 158. Have you been influenced by this book?
I've read the book. I've also read Howard Mincher's book. I've also read Truman Bethaven's book, and they have some really interesting things to say. As a matter of fact, what they corroborate what my sources say.
Well, if it also says that this group that Adamski got his information from says they have a large laboratory just beyond the rim of the moon, out of sight of Earth. So if that's the case, that means that our guys are working with these guys up there, unless they're coming from another dimension, right?
Not another dimension. They come from, they come from probably another planet. But I think on the livingmoon.com, there's a picture of Zond that Zond 3 took, and it's an amazing picture. It was the first Russian, one of the first Russian pictures of the backside of the moon, and for some reason they didn't airbrush it. Now it's not that clear, but you can see gigantic structures there. As a matter of fact, on the edge, on the limb of the moon from Zond 3, you can see a structure. It has three enormous tanks, and on the right side of it, it has enormous arch, and the thing has got to be at least 20 miles long and 10 miles high. And that's a Zond Russian picture. I mean, it's in any of the books, and it's on, I think it's posted on thelivingmoon.com. Take a look at it.
Well,
and it's thelivingmoon.com, right?
Thelivingmoon.com, right?
Okay, you got to put the "the" in there, folks, not just livingmoon.com. Any more questions, Blair?
Well, I was wondering if I could put by, and thanks, George, about the TV set analogy of our reality. In other words, you know, if we're on channel 3 of a big cosmic TV set, these folks can be on 5 and 6, and they downstep in their frequency or vibration, and we get to see them, but most of the time, they're invisible. And if you look 200 years ago, no such thing as X-rays or gamma rays. Well, they were there, but we didn't have the instrumentality sensitive enough to measure it. So aren't we in the same boat with these guys, and we have to take a spiritual notch up before we're able to see them?
Good point. Read some of Sleeper stuff on AboveTopSecret.com. It addresses that.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to our next wild card line. Your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I would like to ask Don if he knows Gerald Carr. He went to take pictures of a comet, Kohoutek. And if you do know him, if he's still alive, and could you help me get in touch with him?
Is he just a photographer, astronomer?
No, he was an astronaut.
Gerald Carr.
Yeah, Colonel Gerald Carr.
How do you spell his last name?
C-A-R-R.
Okay.
You know, I haven't heard of him.
No.
It was in 1973, and he, well, the mission for the comet Kohoutek is not mentioned in any of the NASA.
What is that mission?
It was a comet.
Well, I know that, but what was the mission?
He told me I was an artist, and I made a piece of jewelry that he took with him in his private pack. And he told me that they were going up to take pictures of this comet, the comet Kohoutek.
Okay, was he part of the secret astronaut corps?
Well, I don't know if it was secret or not.
Well, it must have been. Nobody knows who he is.
He's listed in, let's see, 1973.
I got to do a little search on him. What was his first name?
Gerald.
Gerald Carr.
G-E-R-A-L-D, Gerald Carr.
All right.
Anyway, I think he would talk to me about the mission, considering he took a piece of my art with him.
How old was he then?
I don't know.
Did you meet him or just talk with him on the phone?
I met him. I did a show at NASA in 73.
What kind of show?
A jewelry show.
All right.
And he commissioned me to do a piece of a ring for him. It's 72 grams of silver. The motif is the comet going across the sun, and he has the one-carat diamond set in the head.
Well, Gerald like to... P. Carr, he exists. Gerald Carr, let's see, he was born August 22nd, 1932. That makes, 70, he's going to be 75 years old. So he's not an astronaut anymore.
No.
He seems to still be alive,
okay.
I think.
Does it say what mission he was on?
Let's see where was what mission. Special honors, experience. When informed of NASA of his selection for astronaut training, he was assigned as test. He logged the NASA experience. He was one of the 19 astronauts selected by NASA in 1966. He served as a member of the astronaut support crew for Apollos 8 and 12. He was the commander of Skylab 4.
Uh-huh.
Launched in 1973.
Right.
Okay, well, that would have been it.
And then he retired from NASA in 1977. He is still alive, and you may find him. He might still be in Houston.
Okay.
Let's see. Where could he be? Family owned business. Sorry to be just mumbling like this. He may be in Houston. He exists.
Good. I'd like to get another copy of a picture of the ring that I made for him.
I'm looking at his hand now, and he's not wearing the ring in this NASA.
No, he got it for his wife, and she didn't like it because it was too heavy. So he said, we're keeping it because the silver has flown, but we don't know what we're going to do with it. But, it's been some years now.
I went to a portion of St. Louis University, Parks College at the time. Okay. Hey, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening.
Hi.
I heard earlier that Mr. Lear did mention that he thought that there was a thin but survivable atmosphere.
Yes, a breathable atmosphere.
And
it's
then,
equal to about 15,000 feet on Earth.
Yeah, a little thinner than what we experience at sea level. Well, I had a fascinating book when I was a kid about the moon, and it said in year 1999 or whatever, they said we'll have domes on the moon, and they had little cars and stuff rolling around. And I got kind of interested in that type of stuff, and I could have swear I remember a book from when I was a young teenager, The Hollow Moon.
Yeah.
Well, there's one called The Hollow Earth.
I remember Admiral Byrd, and
right.
I was fascinated by that story, too.
Is there one out there called The Hollow Moon? I don't know.
I can't quite remember.
I'll check.
But I do remember that someone surmised or put the thought in my head that at one point the moon had a pretty much full atmosphere like our own. And a large object going real fast narrowly missed it and sucked away a lot of it, leaving it with a thin atmosphere. Now, that stone kept going, and it must not have hit the Earth because it would have been just too much, I think. But what do you think the action would have been to the Earth itself from a large object spinning end over end, going right by, near miss? What would that do to the Earth? Would that switch its magnetic field?
Well,
there'd
be some
problems.
Tinker
with its rotation or make it wobble like a top getting close to the end of its issue or something?
There'd be some problems. I don't know exactly what they'd be. I don't think it took the moon's atmosphere. The moon's atmosphere has always been what it is because of its size.
Absolutely. And let's see, checking this book, nothing like having the great references here. Exit the Hollow Moon, Midnight Moon, that's all I have. Exit the Hollow Moon. Mm-hmm. That's it. Exit the Hollow Moon. That's about it. That sounds like it's a fictional book. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you guys doing?
We're doing great. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for the great work you guys are both doing. It's really important stuff. Hey, John, I was hoping to get on earlier to back you up. I remembered something I read. Dr. John Freeman and Dr. Ken Hills investigating a vapor cloud over 100 square miles on the moon. So there's definitely been incidents where vapor has been detected that they can't explain. So.
Oh, yeah, there's pictures of, NASA has pictures of clouds even on the near side. And so there's no doubt that there's an atmosphere there.
I wanted to ask you, what is your take on the possibility that the moon and possibly some of the other moons around other planets in the solar system arrived here with a third body, be it Planet X or whatever you want to call it, that tore through and caused a lot of the strange little oddities that we find all the way out to Pluto and stuff, and possibly that Planet X hit a planet that Mars was orbiting, causing all the strange stuff that, for example, Mr. Hoagland has found on his site and they're part of their data sets.
I don't know too much about that.
We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial. Hey, John, have you ever been threatened by any government types just to stay quiet?
Never. Never the slightest bit of that have I ever experienced.
You know, people ask me that, too. Never happened. They just leave us alone, don't they?
They do. And, you know, considering all the stuff that Above Top Secret and my friend Springer has put on that forum, it's really interesting. I mean, he put on the Copernicus pictures in all their glory, and they are there now if anybody wants to go see them, and also thelivingmoon.com.
What's next on your agenda, John, these days?
Well, I've got this little gold mine here that I'm trying to start up in Gold Butte. It's been 5 years going. I'm just waiting for it to get warm enough so I can get out there and start milling.
Have you found any little nuggets yet?
It's not. It's hard rock. They don't have nuggets.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And it's the only certificated gold mine in southern Nevada, certificated and operating gold mine.
Now, how do you know there's gold there?
It's a vein that's been mined for 100 years.
Okay. Well, you might hit the mother lode. You never know.
No, it'll be maybe an ounce at the best per ton. But, I'm retired. I don't need that much. In a beautiful place called Gold Butte.
You're doing it for fun primarily?
Yeah.
Okay. Back to the calls we go. Let's pick it up by going west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello there. Happy New Year. This is Julia in Ashland.
Hi, Julia.
And I have a couple questions for John. I was interested in this soul catcher theory. And, you know, John, I follow you until you get to this point, and then I start to fear for your sanity a little bit. I just would like to know, first of all, you said they shoot the soul back into the body when the baby's pretty clear to live past a couple of days. Well, obviously they made a lot of mistakes on that one. And who's they who are doing this? And they must know the soul's past lives, I assume. How do they decide which souls reincarnate? Is this like some assembly line and then they just randomly select them? Do they have a design that makes us, you know, repress our past lives, memories of it? And then why do some of us recall our past lives like I do?
Everybody has many, many past lives. And yes, there is a design. When you die, they know exactly where you're going next. And if you have to go to a holding place where you have to be taken out behind the woodshed and said, now, you didn't do a very good job this time. Next time, we're going to expect a little bit better.
Who is they, John? Extraterrestrials or dimensional people?
Yeah, the extraterrestrials are people who run this operation. You know, we just didn't grow here from fish. Somebody put us here, somebody made us here, and we're part of the big design. There are billions of places just like Earth all over the universe, and people are in various stages of development. Some are more advanced than us, some are less advanced than us, but there's Earth all over the place, billions of them.
Well, how can they expect us to make any progress if we can't remember our past lives?
That's the trick.
A lot of people can't, Julie.
The maturing of the soul. We can't cheat.
Why do they repress the memories?
Pardon?
Why would they repress our memories of our past lives if we're supposed to make any progress?
I don't know how that works, but I'll tell you one guy who does, and that's Sleeper. And
got to get Sleeper on.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, if you could get him on, boy, I'll tell you, it would be great. He's short and to the point, and he has a heck of a good sense of humor.
Okay, we'll work on that. Next up, let's go to our next wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Where are you calling from?
Hey, Mark in Philly.
Okay, Mark.
Hey, and on that last caller, I wouldn't worry too much about past lives. We're on the verge of becoming immortal like the Anunnaki before us, at which point there's not going to be a whole lot of repeats going on. You're just going to sort of hang around. But and for your gold digging that you're going to be doing, that's also your Anunnaki birthright, because supposedly they created us as gold lusting after slave workers.
Yeah, that's William Bramley's theory.
Well, Zechariah Sitchin. Specifically, at least as I follow. But listen, and as far as being called and being left alone, I have been called by somebody from an alphabet agency because of some stuff that I was doing. I used to run a website that focused on the second face at Sidonia, called Face 2 at Sidonia, the Anunnaki, as I called it. And we used to put up all kinds of wild new discoveries leading right up to that 1998 new image release,
if you'll
recall.
Yeah.
And we posted all kinds of two different dolphins that were found there in that same area, just like the two faces and so on. Well, every 6 hours, the website eventually was being whacked by an acronym agency where it would suck down hundreds of pages every second. So it was keeping a copy. And I used to get sometimes 3,000 visitors a day, and about 50% of them were government and .mil IP addresses, right?
Yeah.
So I started collecting them, and I started discovering all kinds in there, including eventually E0001.eop.gov. Which I think you can figure out who that probably was. Executive Office of the President,
yeah.
Executive One. Anyway, so I started cutting off the IP addresses and putting W's at the front, and eventually my main point here in support of what you were saying before, while I don't think that it's likely that somebody's walking out with a can of Windex, it's way too risky to be pulling malarkey like that. You have the dust devils to take care of that as far as the rovers. I do think it's likely that we are probably to some degree at Mars, and the reason is because I backdoored just going, to what I thought were publicly available or not, websites, but to some of these very strange IP addresses, and I came up with one of the various space battle labs that you might have seen online. But this one had a spinning GIF animation with a logo or sort of a badge for whatever group this was.
Yeah.
And on one side of it, and I swear to God, on one side of it is this, the Stars and Stripes and rockets and all kinds of space-looking launch-type vehicles. And on the flip side is a, white-suited, gold helmet, I can remember clear as day, gold helmet-covered astronaut standing in front of a red city with a red atmosphere behind it, holding some kind of space-looking rifle in his hands. So, this is back in 98, and that's just something that I sort of fell back into. And once I saw that, I disconnected the connection and, cut off from that stuff for a little while because, I just didn't want to, take the heat. But the bottom line is I agree with about 90% of what you had to say. I think everything from the launch vehicles to what is probably a soon-to-be, revealing of themselves to us en masse, primarily because of these sort of, all over the world, these atomic battles that seem to be gearing up between either the Israelis and their neighbors, India and Pakistan, North Korea and anybody, Iran and the U.S. There's too much volatility, and I don't think, even though there may be billions of planets out there that are great, it still seems like Earth, the reason they came here, according to the Bible, the sons of the gods came down to mate with the fairest women. They like our Earth women, and I think they're coming here for that and the gold mining and all the variety of other reasons.
Possibly. George, wasn't it with you that that lady called in that was at NASA, and she was watching the TV monitor of Mars, and the guy comes up, and they saw the two people walking across
mm-hmm.
the landscape?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, sure is. You have mentioned, by the way, that we have two Hubble telescopes. Explain that one, John.
Right. There was one that the public knows about, and then the other one was strictly military. And a few years ago, you'll remember the one that the public knows about, they said it went bad. It didn't go bad. What they did is they needed it for another mission.
Took it out of commission.
So they told the public that it was out of commission, and the military used that one too. And they were tracking something that was in space, and I don't know what that was. And then when they finished that mission, they put it back into commission, and now we have that one. But there still is the other military Hubble. There's two Hubbles.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there, welcome.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to talk about the Giza pyramid and the crop circles, if it's okay.
We're not doing that tonight with John Lear. However, during open lines Friday night, more than welcome to call in about that. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George?
Yeah.
George, this is Bruce in Austin, Texas, and just wanted to commend the show tonight. I'm kind of new to listening to your show.
I'm going
to
be in Austin in another week, Bruce. Come on by. Yeah.
Yeah, I really wanted to do that. I'm going to buy your book and read it, hopefully before I meet you.
Well, even if you don't buy the book, come on by.
Yeah, well, I want it. I mean, the book sounds real interesting, but yeah, I wanted to welcome you to Austin. I know you've been here before. So that event, it's just on the, 26th or 27th?
Yeah, I've got the show on the 26th, the radio show, and then the event's on the 27th. Let's hope there's no more ice out there, huh?
Yeah, it's going to go away tomorrow. I think it's starting to get above freezing, so it'll be just fine by the time you get here.
All right, great. Thanks, Bruce. But go ahead.
Hey, John, I really appreciate, you just doing the show, and I got the websites. What's the other one, the Legend website you were talking about?
Landoflegends.us.
Okay, I'll make sure I get that. I won't keep you guys very long, but I just wanted to thank you for a great program, and we'll see you next week, George.
Okay, I shall be there. Thanks, appreciate you calling the show. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. We put some more wild card lines in, so these phones keep ringing. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Dave from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Green Bay, Wisconsin, the home of the Green Bay Packers.
You bet.
All right.
Yeah, I work in Appleton. My buddy Howie and I listen to you all the time.
Thanks.
I got a couple questions here.
Okay.
The Russians have been sending up spacecrafts to outer space and charged millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Where are they going? And the second question is, the International Space Station, what are they doing with that, and what does that have to do with anything to do with the moon and, you know, what's going on? Does that have any occurrence? Can your guest tell me about that?
Okay, David, I'll let you listen on the radio. $20 million that people are paying the Russians to shoot them off into space, John. I think they just do some orbits and they come back.
Absolutely, that's all they do.
That's a lot of money for just that.
Yep.
But if they have it, it's theirs, I guess, huh?
And he asked about the International Space Station.
Yep.
As far as I know, they don't do anything except try and hold it together.
You know, I have for years wondered what that thing is going to do one day.
Nothing. It's just a cover. It's for the public to look at. Say, oh, man, isn't that great? You know, we can see it going around while they're mining the moon, going to Mars, going to other planets.
Billions of dollars to divert our attention.
Right. It worked really good, and we would have never found out about it if I hadn't stumbled, made two, you know, very good connections, the one government insider and the pictures in SP-246, which was a NASA publication called Lunar Photographs of Apollo 8, 10, and 11, and started looking really closely at those pictures and wondering, boy, I wonder what's in there. You know, NASA has two code words for airbrushing. One is ejecta, and the other is slump. And the slump, you can see in the crater Kepler, it's a white triangle, and they've referred to it as slump. It's not. It's an airbrush triangle. And the ejecta is the white stuff you see all over the, coming out of the volcanoes, or the craters. There's no white stuff. That ejecta is airbrush stuff. But they weren't proficient enough in the early days with it. Now they are, but they weren't in the early days. So those of us who have the early photographs get to see some of the really cool stuff that's up there.
I didn't get your reaction to Ingo Swann's remote viewing of the far side of the moon.
Oh, where my he says God, George. Somebody has promised me a book, an original book of Ingo Swann's, and I've been waiting a year for it. And what a great guy. I just love to read that book.
My aunt thought the world of him. They just they work together. on some projects.
Really?
And
well, I've been promised a book, and you know, you can't get one anymore.
No, so. You can't. I mean, they sell. I think if you can go to Amazon.com, you might find one. But I think they go for at least a couple hundred bucks now.
Oh, no, they're more than that.
Are they really?
I'd get one for a couple hundred
bucks. I'm going to find out right now while we're taking a few more calls before
okay.
we wrap things up.
Okay.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Is this me now, George?
It sure is, sir.
All right, thank you very much. This is Harry from the Seattle area.
Okay, Harry.
Couple of questions, actually. Do you believe, John, that the reason that the little guy is able to have this information is to bring us up to that next level of spirituality where we are able to conceptualize all of these ideas that are being given to us about the moon and things like that?
It's not so much spirituality as it is a maturing of the soul.
Right.
In other words, our society, when we get up in the morning, we look for the first guy to shoot. And so we've got to learn to more, you know, express more love, reflect more love. And that's basically what it's all about. And we're a long ways from there.
Oh, dude, definitely a long ways away. And also, which one of your other guests, I mean, other persons that was calling in would actually ask, do you believe in the hollow earth theory?
Yes.
So do I. And, George, I know that is a topic that goes very deep with you, and I actually have the book, The Hollow Earth, and I've had it for quite some time because you can't find it anymore.
No, I've got that, too. A little red cover, isn't it?
That's the one.
Yep, okay.
And I actually have it in a photocopy because you can't have that. And it's really interesting to me that we don't have anything on, like, TLC, the History Channel, or anything giving us any information about Richard Byrd. Now, that makes me believe that because of the fact that you don't hear anything talked about, that it must be there.
I think landoflegends.us has a lot of stuff of Richard Byrd. Ron Schmidt, my associate, he knows a lot about that, has a lot of videotape, and the tie-in with everything. That's very interesting. As far as the Hollow Earth, yeah, it's hollow. There is much more going on down there than there is up here. And it's a very difficult concept for people, but in fact, it's true. I was talking with a TV production studio the other day about the ocean that extends under Nevada, California, and Utah, a huge ocean under there. And I was mentioning that there was two Navy submarines lost under there. One was Thresher, and I'm trying to think what the other one. It could have been, Scorpion. And those were allegedly lost in the Atlantic, and, you know, there's this and that, and it's not true. They were lost in the while they were exploring the ocean.
So I'm on Amazon.com, John, and there are four penetration books left, four. And the lowest price is $380. The highest is $860. Isn't
Thank
that
you.
Incredible?
Yeah, I'd pay that for it.
There's four of them. If you want to go onto Amazon, you probably pick up the one for $380. It goes to $430, $525, and $860.
I'll do it. And, I thought they were over $1,000.
You know, I might be able to pick one up, have Ingo sign it, and then sell it back again on Amazon. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Mine goes for $14. I guess, you know, there's a big difference. That is a good book. Got to pick that up. I may pick that up, too. Hey, John, we're coming up to the end. Maybe we can squeeze in one more call. Wild card line real quickly. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Adam in Utah.
Hi, Adam.
John, I just wanted to ask you, you were talking about the SR-71 earlier. My grandfather retired from Lockheed in the late 70s, I think, and on his retirement poster, has everybody that signed it, and nothing to do with really what he did, but on the very top it has a Roadrunner. And a bunch of signatures around the Roadrunner. And then we found out in the 80s he worked on the SR-71 when he was finally allowed to talk about it. Does that relate a little bit to the people he used to work with?
Yeah, that's the Roadrunner group, and we meet every 2 years. I'm an associate member because I really had nothing to do except a tremendous interest. And I was the guy that found the story where they stored the original CIA birds. They were parked down at the fire station at Plant 42, which is Palmdale, and I got the original picture of that. One thing that most people don't know is we gave Russia an SR-71 in 1991. We gave it to Gorbachev, and the deal was if Gorbachev promised not to supply any troops, information, ammunition, or guns to Iraq, that we would leave one SR-71 in Moscow and train their pilots and support it, and that airplane is still there.
John Lear, I love talking with you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
wonderful guy. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Stephanie Smith, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.